Welcome to this 11KBW podcast on FOIA and EO Heart by Leo Davidson. This talk was given at the 11KBW Information Law Conference at the Kelvin Theatre, IET London Savoy Place. For more podcasts and information, please visit 11kbw.com.
Defamatory to say that I'm Peter Lockley, but I'm very happy to be here to talk to you about FOIA, about EIR. I appreciate it's not the big ticket issue, but there are still some really interesting things happening in the tribunal, and there are some knock-on effects that affect other issues, especially when we talk about procedural issues in the tribunal. So, starting with the Freedom of Information Act, these are some of the cases that we're going to be talking about. NHS England, which sort of basically follows forward the Malnick case, which many of you will be familiar with. The CFI case, which talks about how to deal with a request, more from the tribunal's point of view. And then a couple of cases about the balancing test, O'Hanlon, which really talks about how we're all supposed to treat FTT cases, not really authorities at all. And then the question of when that balancing test is to be carried out if you're moved forward in time. And then the EIR, a couple of cases about that. One is the perennial question, what is environmental information? What comes under the EIR as opposed to FOIA? And then a case about vexatious requests, really what are called manifestly unreasonable requests under the EIR. So another title page for you. So the NHS England case, it doesn't really matter what happened in the case for the purposes of this talk. Basically, the appeal was upheld and the FTT disagreed with what the public authority had said. But it recognised that there may be other things that the public authority would want to rely on by way of exemptions in order to avoid disclosing the information. So what it did was, it allowed the appeal and then remitted it back to the public authority. So it skips back over the commissioner, goes back to the authority and say, well, you have another stab at it, think about what exemption might apply, and then follow the process through again, and there'll be a complaint, et cetera, et cetera. So the problem was, according to the upper tribunal, that Malnick does not allow that to happen. Malnick says that once the authority has got it off its desk, it's done. Once the commissioner has got it off her desk, she's done. And then it's in the tribunal's hands. Now, I have to say, I have a personal connection with this case because I know Ed Malnick, who brought the Malnick case. And he's very pleased with himself that I spend all my time referring to him by citing this case. I was really hoping that this NHS England case was going to take over as the go-to case. It hasn't, unfortunately. So we still talk about Malnick and what Malnick decided. So the upper tribunal says this is what it got wrong. It should have held onto it and remitted it to the extent that it had to come back and make more submissions, but still maintain its jurisdiction over the case. So effectively a sort of interim decision, keep the proceedings live, but give the public authority another chance to consider it. One final thing to say about this case is that it suffers from May's law, named after Theresa May, where the more you say something's very clear, the less clear that thing is likely to be. And what the NHS England case said was that, I don't understand, Malnick is so clear, it's so easy to apply. And in many cases, it isn't. But the practical outcome of NHS England, the way it clarifies Malnick, is that if you're the public authority and you've got maybe two or three different exemptions you want to rely on, and perhaps some of them you think are a knockout blow, especially if something is about burden, so you don't actually want to go through the burden of finding out what other things might apply, you may get a second bite of the apple, or maybe even a third, depending on how it works out. But of course, once the tribunal's got it in its, has seized it, the tribunal has its duties to manage costs and to further its overriding objective. So although in theory there'll be issues around making sure that things aren't improperly disclosed, the tribunal will also have to have regard to cost and proportionality as well. So the CFI case, CFI put in one request which had two limbs. So it talked about these two cases, and the fact was that one of them could be answered very easily, and the other one was very burdensome. And because of that burden, the Home Office ultimately rejected or refused to disclose information because it said that the request was too burdensome. CFI, the Upper Tribunal, makes clear that the terms of the request are entirely a matter for the requester. So the requester puts in the request that they want, they frame the request as they see fit, and there are two powers that the public authority has to go back. One is to clarify if it's genuinely unclear, and the other one is to give advice and assistance where you say, well, it seems like you might want something else, so maybe you could refine or redraw your request in a certain way. But all you can do is make the offer and give the advice. You can't actually answer a question that you haven't been asked. You can't provide information to respond to a request that you haven't been given, because then you're not actually complying with your duty. And the first tier tribunal, when it gets to that to them, have to apply the law to the request as it is, because as it is, if they refuse to change the request and the request as it was originally made, if they do change it, then the request as it becomes. But the tribunal itself has no power, any more than the public authority or the commissioner does, to redefine the request or to apply some purposive interpretation to what the request ought to have been. And so there we see the ratio, the second paragraph. The tribunal criticised the Home Office for not segregating the information within the request, but the request itself had not done that. So the Home Office had to deal with the request as it came in. Reiterates the point that we're all familiar with. A request can be vexatious purely by reason of the cost burden. The importance of that, of course, is that allows you to take into account the burden of applying or considering redactions to take into account other exemptions, which is not something that Section 12, which is the pure appropriate limit cost burden provision, allows you to do. It's not one of the things you're allowed to take into account in that section. So if you've got something, you can find it and collate it very quickly, but actually you're going to have to go through it page by page by page, redacting for personal data, for commercial information, whatever it is. That's something you can take into account for Section 14, but obviously you still have to follow through the whole set of considerations that apply. So there was no lack of clarity in this request. If a request is clear, then you have no power to go back and ask for clarification. You have to take it at its face. If it's very obvious what the scope of the request is, then you have to. You can go back and say, well, are you sure this is what you wanted to ask? But you can't unilaterally change it, and you can't ask them to clarify. You can ask them to refine it, which is a slightly different thing. This is the case of O'Hanlon. Talking about the main point is about whether the FTT should be taken as authority when it makes pronouncements about the law. This is also known as LO and the Information Commissioner. And if you fancy a tearjerker, you can go on Panopticon blog, where Chris Knight blogged briefly about this case and how hard it made his life in terms of legal research when the Upper Tribunal decides to not quite anonymised, because the case itself still has O'Hanlon's name in it, but they choose to initialise the name of the case for some reason, but it's also known as O'Hanlon. It's a Section 42 case, which is a legal professional privilege, made to the Commissioner herself, the Commissioner's office. The first point is that it does give a little bit of guidance as to how to carry out the public interest balancing test. It says sort of identify what the various public interests are and then decide which one is more significant. And it may be that once you've done that first step, it's pretty obvious where it takes you. But I'm not sure how much that does help. It basically seems to say the same thing as the statute. The other thing, my colleague Zoe Gannon, she asked the upper tribunal, to correct a mistake as to the law that the first year tribunal had made. And the upper tribunal said, well, why? So what if they made a mistake? It's not something that relates to or affects the outcome of the case. FTT cases decide the issues between the parties that are put before them, but they don't provide any precedent to any other case. Well, what's the problem? Well, the ICO, in its guidance especially, but also in other aspects and when it's making decisions, relies very heavily on first-tier tribunal cases. And if you go through any of its guidance, it goes through, makes various points, and most of the cases referred to will be first-tier tribunal cases. And the simple reason for that is there's so many more of them, and they the issues so rarely do reach the upper tribunal level. So while first tribunal decisions need to be taken into account and given the respect that they are due, and while it is a proper and valuable process for the Information Commissioner and the ICO to take these cases into account and to derive lessons learned, etc., it doesn't follow that they should be so worried about the way in which these judgments come out. And indeed, the upper tribunal slightly crabbily said, well, you know, I'll do it this one time, but I think there's a problem here with how you're actually treating first tribunal cases and sort of giving a hint that we should perhaps dial it back and make sure that we're actually focusing on the law and not considering ourselves bound, whoever we are, by what the first year tribunal is saying, if they are getting it wrong. So the final case on freedom of information, this is the Merizzi case. A request about correspondence held by the CPS about Julian Assange. And the question was, well, when the tribunal or anybody actually comes to make these decisions about how public interest balancing exercises were carried out, you could be years down the line. Things can change, obviously, in the meantime. So it dug up an old question, but it affirmed what was said in Apja and indeed in Evans. It both found that Apja was binding on it, the upper tribunal, but also said, well, even if I wasn't bound by that, I would still have found the same, because it's a simple matter of applying the law. And the upshot is, as we're probably all familiar with, that you still have to look to the point at which the public authority would have made that decision as to what the public interest balancing would have been or was. There may be things that come to light following that which shed light on what the position actually was or should have been. That's a separate issue, but you don't say, well, over 4 years down the line, things have changed, and therefore the public interest as of today's date changes things at all. That's not how it's supposed to be approached. However, a word of warning, this is something which applies on the face of the precedent, on the face of the authorities, to the public interest balancing test. So under Section 2, you've got your exemption. It's a qualified exemption. I've got to decide whether my interest in, or the public interest, I should say, in maintaining that exemption outweighs the public interest in disclosure. There are other non-qualified or absolute exemptions, for example, the Section 40, which relates to data protection, and others where there are ongoing requirements as a public authority, which would include the tribunal, of course, is bound by, not to breach. So where fundamental rights, which could be Article 8, it could be Article 6, whatever it may be, or indeed, as a matter of EU law, the fundamental right about data protection, all of these rights, if at the date of the disclosure something has changed in the meantime that would make it a breach of, say, one of the data protection principles, and therefore unfair, or, you know, therefore unlawful to disclose it, that should be taken out. So that this is not authority that you consider everything at the date of the request being responded to, something that you should be keeping separate in your minds as you're responding in tribunal proceedings and making submissions. So moving on to the EIR. So here we go, the perennial question of what is environmental information. It's related to a meeting between the Prince of Wales and a minister of the Department for Transport, and the upshot was that disclosure was ordered. It had been withheld on the basis of an absolute exemption, which is Section 37, but it should have been dealt with, it was argued, under the EIR 2004, which does not contain such an exemption, simply not one of the exemptions referred to there. So the Court of Appeal was called upon to ask, well, was the information environmental information? So the Court of Appeal last considered this most substantively in Henney, and obviously it's of very important, great importance for the purposes of answering the request, which you're supposed to consider under, because the environmental information regulations are much more stringent in a variety of ways. So the definition is set out in the regs, derived from the directive. And it's any information, and then C is usually the one where people get a bit stuck, where it's material form on measures, such as policies, legislation, plans, programs, environmental agreements, and activities affecting or likely to affect the elements and factors referred to in A and B, which are obviously above, as well as measures or activities designed to protect those elements. Those elements being things like land and water and that kind of thing. So in this case, you've got the upper tribunal basically saying, well, when you look at it, you can kind of get a sense. You apply the law and you really, the answer reveals itself. And it didn't get into the kind of what it calls careful and rigorous analysis that the tribunals have done. It doesn't criticize them for doing that, but it seems to be implying a more impressionistic approach that you know when you see it. What is environmental vision? We'll just look at it in the round. And it's sort of one of those topsy-turvy situations where the upper tribunal, which actually does have the ability to set precedent and to provide helpful authority on these questions, basically shirking that task and saying, well, why don't you just look at it? It's easy. It calls it an easier task. Simply just look at the small amount of information of material, reach a decision one way or the other. In short, with the assistant described, when one went to the close material without too much theorising, all fell into place. And the tribunals, God bless them, had taken it upon themselves to really get into all the case law and think about all the different moving parts and the various factors that fed into it. And the tribunal swept it all away and said, the upper tribunal said, that's not the way to approach it. No criticism of doing that, but actually, in appropriate cases, you can just take a much more, I'm paraphrasing here, a much more gut-feeling approach. And just applying what you know about environmental information to sort of get a sense of whether the information in front of you falls within or without that definition. So it restated the principles in Henney, and again reiterates that in terms of guidance, for mixed information, rarely need to do more than apply these principles to the information as a whole in order to see whether, in context, the disputed elements of the information are on the measure in question. Doesn't wish to expand on those principles in the present case. So not willing to append to or expand the guidance in Henney, says, as I say, you'll know when you see it. The last case I'll be speaking about this morning is the VESCO case. So the requester sought information from GLD about the gas safety regulations, and it was held to be manifestly unreasonable, and the FCT uses the language of vexatious. So vexatious is obviously a Section 14 FOIA terminology. Manifestly unreasonable is under the EIR. It's worth bearing in mind that the leading authority on vexatiousness and manifestly unreasonable requests is still Dransfield, which had considered both regimes, basically said that it can be treated as the same. Having said that, once you're past manifestly unreasonable, the big difference between the EIR and the FOIA is under FOIA, you don't go any further because it's an absolute exemption. It's not a qualified exemption. You don't have to consider have to consider the public interest balance. You may have to have carried out a pseudo public interest balance when you consider the Dransfield factors. So if there's a value or a purpose to the request, that might be something which imports questions which would ordinarily be a question for the public interest balance. So there is a sort of balancing act where you weigh everything in the round, and it's well known that you have to take everything into account when you consider whether something is vexatious. But then, very strangely, the environmental information regulations, well, even once you've decided that something is manifestly unreasonable, which presumably does take into account whether something is reasonable in context, and therefore it's manifestly unreasonable in light of how little value, for example, the request actually has, you then have to go on to do two further things. First, you have to do the public interest balance. That's on the face of the regulations. You still have to do it. in the same way that you have to do that if it turns out that you say the information is not held. You still have to go on and say, well, we don't hold the information, and the public interest in disclosing the information we don't hold does not outweigh the public information of maintaining the exemption, which is that we don't hold it. So you have to do your public interest balancing test. And even once you've done that, you have to apply the question of whether the presumption in favour of disclosure, which applies under the EIR but not under FOIA, means that the information should in any event be disclosed. So for stage one, you can look at the authorities of vexations under FOIA because they are very similar and in many ways overlapping questions, although the wording is different. The hurdle is high, and the sort of foundation stone of that analysis is whether there's no reasonable foundation for thinking that the information sought would be of value to the requester or indeed the public or any section of the public, judged objectively. So it's basically saying, well, the value of this request, given the burden it's going to pose on the authority and the detraction from other things the authority might be doing with that time and with those resources, is this a reasonable request? Is it manifestly unreasonable? It's a very high hurdle, as you'd expect. And the Dransfield factors are relevant but not an exhaustive checklist, which we already knew, of course. And among the things taken into account are previous requests, whether those requests were the same body, the lapse of time, particularly between requests, and whether there's been a change in circumstances. So again, these are very familiar. So if you're familiar with vexatious requests, it's a very similar analysis that you have to carry out. So you then get to stage two, where everything begins to get a little bit like angels dancing on the head of a pin. Well, simply the fact that it's manifestly unreasonable is not a basis for refusing. You still have to go on to apply the public interest, which is fact-specific. But then the real question is, well, what are the facts that you won't have already taken? What's not already priced in by being manifestly unreasonable? So you go back to the Hanlon case that we talked about identifying the public interests in disclosure, in withholding, and you stack them up against each other and you see which stack is higher, which one is more significant, in the words of O'Hanlon. But it's hard to imagine what factual scenario would actually lead to a change in position between one and two, where you said, well, this is manifestly unreasonable, but there's a really big public interest. Well, you'd think that if there was such a strong public interest in disclosure, then you would have taken into account, therefore it wouldn't be a manifestly unreasonable request. But you still have to carry out the analysis, and it's conceivable that there would be a situation where you had someone had not managed to get over the hurdle, rather the authority had got over the hurdle on the first one but not the second stage of the analysis. And then finally, just as a last check, if the disclosure doesn't result from the first two stages, consider that there's a presumption in favour of disclosure under the EIR, which may at that stage cause you to change your analysis, but again, it's not clear why that would not just be priced in already to the first two stages at least. So the tribunal accepted this was a burdensome analytical process, but the point of it is to ensure the policy of the directive and the regs which implement the directive are properly considered and implemented, and of course, as always, applying the EIR, the grounds for refusal are to be restrictively interpreted. And that's all I have to say about that, and I leave you in the very capable hands.